Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take complex, cutting-edge research and turn it into the crucial, actionable knowledge you need. Today, we are diving deep into the fascinating reality of human sensory augmentation. We are exploring how people build a reliable, complex mental map of the world, even when their primary input, vision is absent.
It's an exploration into enhancing an already powerful, natural skill. Our sources today center on a detailed technical paper introducing a revolutionary new device. It's designed to leverage physics to deliver sight through sound, the Audible High-Resolution Ultrasonic Sonar System, or AHRUS.
AHRUS, yeah, it sounds like something Q would hand James Bond, right? But it's a genuine technological breakthrough. It's intended as an electronic aid for visually impaired and blind individuals. Our mission today is to unpack the extreme technical foundations of AHU, specifically how it uses nonlinear physics to work its magic, and then see precisely how it stacks up against the long-established natural skill of human echolocation, often called flash sonar. We need to find those breakthrough nuggets of insight that show how sound can deliver the high-resolution data needed to reliably replace sight. Okay, let's start by setting the stage. Before we talk about the augmentation, let's define the baseline skill that AHUS is designed to supersede: active human echolocation.
Absolutely. Active echolocation is a phenomenal skill developed by many visually impaired individuals across the world. They actively generate sound, often a specific sharp tongue click known as flash sonar, to create echoes. The human brain then processes those returning echoes to construct that incredibly detailed mental spatial map of the environment.
And the performance of trained users is genuinely impressive. The research we are looking at notes that these dedicated practitioners achieve enormous perception performances. That's the quote. They can determine the position, the size, and even the density of objects around them. What's truly remarkable is that brain scan research shows the brain's visual cortex actually supports this construction process. Essentially, the visual processing centers, lacking input from the eyes, get repurposed to handle this highly refined acoustic data.
It's a stunning example of neuroplasticity. But here's the rub. Even with that incredible neural adaptation, the performance of classical human echolocation runs directly into, the immutable laws of physics. The major constraint is the long wavelength of acoustic sound waves. We're talking about wavelengths ranging dramatically from 80 all the way up to 800 millimeters.
Wow, 800 millimeters. That is a massive range. For our listener, can you give us a sense of scale? 800 millimeters is almost a yard.
Exactly. Yeah, nearly 3 feet. When you are generating sound waves that are sometimes, 30 inches long, you run into the fundamental problem that high resolution is impossible. You have to compare these long acoustic wavelengths to the ultrasonic waves used by bats, for instance. They achieve submillimeter precision because their wavelengths are tiny.
Right. And I always associate high resolution with short wavelengths, like in light or, specialized radar. So because acoustic waves are so long, what specific physical challenge do they face in the environment?
They struggle immensely with diffraction. To use an analogy, imagine trying to tell the exact weave pattern of a fine chain link fence by throwing a massive inflated beach ball at it.
Okay, yeah. The beach ball, being so large, would simply curve around the thin wires or just pass right through them without a strong, reliable reflection.
Precisely. The sound energy passes around obstacles that are smaller than the wavelength without a significant reflection. The research specifically calls out that classical echolocation often fails to detect objects like fine chain fences, low-lying bushes, or thin vertical piles, because the acoustic waves diffract too easily. The energy wraps right around them.
Got it. So a visually impaired person using a cane can feel a low curb, but the flash sonar might miss a thin branch or a post above the cane height if the wave simply bends around it.
That's the resolution problem. But there's a second major hurdle, which the paper refers to as the stealth effect challenge. This relates to smooth surfaces. When acoustic waves reflect off smooth surfaces, think polished stone, glass, or even typical building walls, they behave perfectly according to the law of reflection, just like light off a mirror.
Ah, okay. And if that mirror is tilted slightly, the reflection goes off at an angle away from the source.
Exactly. If that smooth surface, say a window, a large metal sign, or building wall, is at an unfavorable angle, meaning it's not perpendicular to the user's line of fire, the sound energy is reflected away from the user, not back towards them. The required echo is never returned.
So the object, even if it's massive, becomes acoustically invisible. It's hiding in plain sight. It's the sonic equivalent of a stealth coating.
It is, yeah. the user cannot detect it. And for practitioners relying on this feedback, the world can sometimes appear like what the paper calls a mirror cabinet, where large, smooth walls running parallel to the walking direction are nearly imperceptible. This combination of poor resolution due to long wavelengths and the stealth effect caused by specular or mirror-like reflection is the massive flaw AHR-US was fundamentally designed to overcome.
Okay, that gives us a crystal clear understanding of the limitations. It's actually quite significant. So, if the problem is the long wavelength of acoustic sound, and the solution is clearly the short wavelength of ultrasonic sound, we are talking about 8 millimeter waves, 10 to 100 times smaller. Why haven't people just strapped ultrasonic microphones and headphones onto users for decades? That seems like the obvious first step, doesn't it?
That is the most logical technical question. Absolutely. And the answer requires us to understand how profoundly complex human hearing or spatial hearing really is. If you simply record ultrasonic signals with standard microphones, you can capture the time difference between the two ears, which helps localize the horizontal angle, the azimuth. But that's only two dimensions, left and right.
Right. To determine if an object is in front, behind, on top, or underneath you, the elevation cues, that's the hard part.
Precisely. To process elevation and resolve forward-backward confusion, your brain relies entirely on the incredibly complex direction-dependent filters formed by the unique shape of your outer ear, your pinna.
The head-related transfer function, or HRTF, I've heard of that.
Right. Every single person has a unique HRTF. It's like an acoustic fingerprint shaped by your ears. Trying to digitally record the ultrasonic signals and then translate them through headphones requires creating a perfect digital clone of that unique filter, an incredibly complex task. The digital version almost always fails to provide reliable elevation cues, which leads to chronic problems like forward-backward confusion. You just can't tell front from back reliably.
So you're giving the user high-resolution data via digital means, but their brain can't accurately localize the source in 3D space. It's too sort of high-tech for the brain's analog system to accept.
Correct. The brain rejects the data or misinterprets it because the digital signal bypasses the pinna, which is the necessary physical filter. And this is where AHR-US introduces its technological core. It uses physics to bypass the digital problem entirely through nonlinear acoustics.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. This is the AHR-US breakthrough. The goal, as you said, is to leverage the short wavelength benefits of ultrasonic waves, that's the 8 millimeters, while entirely bypassing the need for complex digital signal processing and those tricky digital HRTFs. How is this achieved?
The key aha concept lies in the sophisticated use of parametric speakers. The AHR-US system uses an array of 19 piezo ultrasound emitters to generate a highly directed focused ultrasonic beam, specifically 40 kilohertz. But critically, it generates this beam at an incredibly high sound pressure level, up to 135 decibels dB.
Wait, 135 dB? That is monumentally loud. Like, if I were standing next to a jet engine, that's the kind of sound level we'd be talking about. That sounds dangerous, or at the very least, incredibly annoying to anyone nearby.
That is an excellent point and a crucial distinction we need to make clear for you, the listener. It is 135 dBOs, but it is at 40 kilohertz. That frequency is well above the range of human hearing, which typically maxes out around 20 kilohertz, so the sound itself is imperceptible to us. Silent.
So it's loud, but silent to the human ear. Phew, okay.
Precisely. And the reason it must be so loud is because at that extreme sound pressure level, the medium through which the sound travels, the air itself, begins to behave in a non-linear manner. The air density changes dramatically under that pressure. It doesn't just transmit the sound passively anymore.
The air itself becomes part of the processing unit. That's wild.
Exactly. This is the phenomenon of self-demodulation or autoconversion. As this highly directed, modulated ultrasonic beam travels through the nonlinear air, the signal gradually and naturally transforms, it demodulates, into an audible acoustic signal. Think of it as the 40 kilohertz carrier wave naturally mixing with itself due to the air's nonlinear response, resulting in a lower frequency audible component.
So the air is doing the work that complex digital processors would otherwise have to do, but it's doing it perfectly, naturally.
It is, and here is the technological genius. The resulting audible acoustic signal retains the crucial physical features of the original short-wavelength ultrasonic signal. The audible sound carries the high-resolution data of the ultrasound wave, the narrow beam characteristic, for instance.
That is truly fascinating. So when the beam hits an object and reflects back, the user perceives the audible echo.
As if the reflecting object itself is the source of the sound. Because this sound is now in the audible range and enters the user's own natural, unique ear past the pinna, the brain can utilize its existing trained spatial hearing skills to perfectly localize the object. No complex digital intervention, no HRTF simulation required. It is a physical solution to a digital problem, feeding high-resolution data directly into the brain's native processing system.
Amazing. And just to confirm, we mentioned the 40 kilohertz frequency. This system is designed to aid mobility. Are there any concerns regarding guide dogs? They have sensitive hearing.
That was a specific design consideration, yeah. Mm-hmm. Guide dogs can typically hear up to around 25 kilohertz. Since the AHR-US beam operates at 40 kilohertz, it's completely harmless and inaudible to them, ensuring it does not interfere with their crucial work. The focused beam also ensures that the intensity drops rapidly once it diffuses, limiting its overall reach and preventing undue disturbance to wildlife in general. It's quite targeted.
Okay, good to know. Before we jump into usage, let's detail the device itself. Beyond the 19 piezometers, what else is integrated? Sounds like a complex bit of hardware.
It's a sophisticated piece of kit, yeah. For configuration and control, it includes a Bluetooth low energy BLE module, usually connected via a smartphone app. Pretty standard stuff there. More importantly, for movement, it has an inertial measurement unit, or IMU, which integrates a 3D compass, gyroscope, and accelerometer.
Ah, like in smartphones, but probably more precise. That's a highly accurate spatial orientation system.
It is. This IMU supports spatial orientation and can provide haptic feedback like vibration for hints or warnings. And critically for the user interface, it features a configurable synthesizer. This allows the user to select the type of signal best suited for the task. Simple clicks, continuous white noise, short bursts, or those special frequency sweeping chirps we'll explore in depth later. Lots of options.
Right. Okay. Moving on to practical application then. This device is a focus beam, not a wide flash like the tongue click. How does a user interact with this precise, almost laser-like sound spotlight? It sounds like it needs a different technique.
It absolutely does. It requires an active scanning approach, much more deliberate than a tongue click. The first and most basic application is simple localization, which the researchers term the acoustic white cane.
The acoustic white cane, I like that. And what's the optimal signal for just simple obstacle detection?
For first-time users, the most intuitive signal is a continuous white noise-like sound, like static, but very directional. When this focused sound hits an object, the echo becomes easily audible and locatable. The auditory impression is described as sounding like a specific localized wind gust. It's directional and distinct, but not intrusive or loud to others nearby.
So you sweep this audible wind gust across the environment. What are the practical advantages of using this focused 8mm wavelength beam versus a wide flash sonar click for a simple localization?
Oh, the advantages are immense, primarily in range and reliability. Due to the focused beam, discernible edges or obstacles up to 10 meters, about 33 feet, become clearly audible and localizable. Flash sonar is often useless past maybe 5 or 6 feet for smaller things. But the truly significant difference lies in how it mitigates the stealth problem we talked about earlier.
Right, the specular reflection from smooth surfaces, the mirror effect.
Exactly, because the ultrasonic waves with their tiny 8mm length trigger diffuse backscattering. They scatter off tiny roughnesses on almost any surface. This means structured grounds like grassland, gravel, or even finely structured objects like bushes and fences, which are completely missed by long acoustic waves, become audibly discernible, even if the beam hits them at a shallow angle. Flash sonar, relying on that clean, directed reflection, fails completely in those scenarios. AHRUS provides reliable echoes regardless of the object's angle, simply because the microscopic roughness is often larger than the tiny 8mm wavelength.
That dramatically increases the confidence a user would have in their navigation, surely. If you know you can reliably hear grass or a fence, you can rely on the system in complex environments, not just echoing off big flat walls. Now, what about estimating distance? We can't use a continuous sound for that, right? The echo would just merge.
That's right. Continuous sounds are unusable for distance estimation. You need short staccato tone or noise bursts, something with a clear start and stop. You're effectively measuring the time delay of the echo's return. The human ear is extremely precise and perceives the delay of the echo very accurately. Very short distances are heard as increasing reverb, sort of a thickening of the sound, while longer distances sound like a distinct time-shifted impulse, click dot echo.
Okay, and how accurate can a user get simply by judging that echo delay, just by listening?
With training, performance is impressive. Experienced users, including one of the authors of the technical paper, actually, were able to estimate distances up to 10 meters, and they did it with an accuracy of between 0.5 to 1.5 meters. That's a remarkable level of precision for pure acoustic estimation.
That really is. And the paper detailed an ingenious training technique to teach less experienced users how to perceive distance reliably, Can we dive into that? It sounded clever.
Yeah, this is a brilliant example of how HRUS leverages human perceptual skill rather than just relying on digital readouts. They recognize that it's difficult for an untrained user to assign an absolute distance to an absolute time delay. Like, what does 60 milliseconds feel like? So they introduced an objective feedback loop. The user adjusts the pulse frequency on the device using a 50% sound silence duty cycle.
Okay, so the signal is 50% noise burst, 50% silence, on, off, on, off.
Correct. The user then targets a known reference object, say 10 meters away. They adjust the pulse frequency, how fast it's turning on and off, until the echo of the broadcast burst exactly hits the silent phase of the next cycle.
Ah, creating a perfectly continuous, unbroken tone for that specific reference distance.
Exactly. For a 10-meter target, the sound travel time, the delay is about 60 milliseconds. Round trip. So setting the burst duration and the subsequent silent gap both to 60 milliseconds means the echo perfectly fills the silent space. The user registers a continuous tone. Then, as the user moves closer or farther, any deviation in distance instantly leads to a gap or overlap between the signal and the echo again, breaking the continuous tone. It becomes choppy.
That's amazing feedback. It's much easier to learn to identify a broken versus a continuous tone than to estimate an absolute time delay in milliseconds. It turns distance perception into a simple audio on-off calibration exercise. Very intuitive.
It relieves the guesswork and provides instant, unambiguous feedback for skill development. Really smart design. Now let's move past localization and distance to the final high-resolution application. Structure and roughness recognition. How do you distinguish, say, a smooth glass door from a rough patch of sidewalk or a hedge?
This sounds like the realm of texture mapping, but with sound.
It is, essentially. And again, it involves exploiting that small 8-millimeter wavelength advantage. Objects with surface roughness below the 8-millimeter ultrasonic wavelength are classified as almost smooth. They deliver a clear, directed echo, like a mirror. Rough objects, however, deliver diffuse, multiple echoes from different parts of the structure, all arriving at slightly different times. The challenge is teaching the brain to hear that difference reliably.
How does the system highlight that difference? Just noise bursts wouldn't capture that complexity, would they?
No. For this, you need chirp signals. A chirp is a signal where the frequency either increases an up chirp or decreases a down chirp over a very short time, like a quick swoop sound. If the chirp hits a perfectly smooth wall, all parts of the wave reflect back almost simultaneously, delivering a clear, distinct chirp echo. You hear the swoop back clearly.
Okay, makes sense. But if it hits a highly structured or rough object, like grass or a thick bush,
then the wave is split. The sound waves reflect off the many tiny surfaces that make up the structure, hundreds of leaves or grass blades, all at slightly different distances from the user. Because the frequency of the chirp is constantly changing, and the time delay of an individual echo corresponds to its flight time. A mixture of echoes from a rough surface, all returning fractions of a millisecond apart, is perceived by the ear as a blurred, noise-like sound. The clear swoop gets smeared out.
Ah, so the noisy sound is the texture. The blurriness of the returning chirp is the brain's way of processing the fact that the wave didn't return simultaneously, that it hit a complex surface.
Precisely. The strength in the spectral distribution, the frequencies present in that noisy sound, correlate directly with the surface structure. This allows the user to differentiate complex textures, like a smooth concrete wall, versus thick grass or porous hedge. It turns what was an abstract technical measurement into a directly perceived auditory texture, similar in principle to how bats use complex chirps for high-resolution target identification.
Okay, that's incredibly sophisticated. We must consider how the user holds and aims this precise device, though. The information received must change dramatically based on how you handle it.
Yes, handling is key. There are three primary modes discussed in the research. The first is head mounting, which is probably the most intuitive for many. The beam follows the line of vision, mimicking natural directionality, and it leaves the hands free for a white cane or guide dog leash. This is similar to the natural tongue click technique in terms of direction, but obviously with much higher resolution and range.
Makes sense. And the other two are handheld, requiring more active engagement from the user.
Correct. The second is handheld scanning. Users perform fast periodic scanning moves by turning the device off the wrist sweeping, maybe an angle of about 45 degrees. It's similar to how one sweeps a white cane back and forth. This is crucial for detecting obstacles above ground level like low-hanging branches, road signs, or letterboxes up to 10 meters away. These are often mobility hazards missed by canes.
Right, head height obstacles. That's a big blind spot, literally. Yeah. And the third method, the triangulation one, sounds more complex. It's for finding the exact location and size of near objects.
Yes, this is a sophisticated two-step method for precise near-field work. First, the user aligns their body to the target object by slowly scanning and finding the peak echo magnitude where the sound is loudest. That points their torso at the object. Once the body is aligned, the user stretches out their arm holding the device and slowly turns their wrist until the beam hits the object again and the echo peaks. The required rotation angle of the wrist, combined with the known position of the device relative to their body, helps estimate the object's distance and exact direction. It's geometric.
It sounds like a sophisticated yet entirely trainable extension of existing orientation and mobility skills. It's like using your body as a navigational compass guided by the sound.
It absolutely is. And this brings us to the crucial part of this deep dive, the quantitative comparison with classical flash sonar. We need to really quantify why this technological leap is worth the complexity and the training.
Let's start by reiterating the core physical difference because it's so important. Flash sonar, 80 to 800 millimeters wavelength. AHRUS, just 8 millimeters. That short wavelength is the foundation of the superiority, right?
That difference underpins everything, yeah. Especially when we look at directivity. Flash sonar is a massive wide burst, often covering an aperture of 45 to 90 degrees, like a floodlight. That single click illuminates a huge area simultaneously. This causes multiple echoes from different reflectors, a wall, a pole, a bush to overlap and clutter the audio scene. The weak echoes from small or distant objects are completely masked by the louder echoes from closer, larger things.
Right. But the AHRUS beam is sharply focused, only about a 6-degree aperture, more like a spotlight.
Yes. This sharp focus allows for selective scanning. The user controls exactly where the sound energy is directed, and the echo only comes from that small targeted area. This leads to dramatically better scanning resolution and highly improved directional perception. When you scan a small pole, you hear only the pole, not the bushes behind it and the wall next to it, all at the same time.
And the loudness advantage flows from that focused beam as well, right? It concentrates the energy.
Precisely. For an echo to be audible, especially from far away, it must be significantly louder than the background noise. A wide area sound source, like a tongue click, rapidly degenerates in loudness with distance because the sound energy is spread out over a quickly growing area. It just dissipates. The sharp, focused 6-degree beam of AHRUs keeps its intensity over a much longer distance. This is the absolute prerequisite for receiving audible echoes from far away or very small objects. You need that power concentrated.
And then there is the definitive solution to the stealth problem, which we call the major failing of classical echolocation, the mirror cabinet issue.
This is perhaps AHRU's most significant contribution to mobility, functionally speaking. We established that the stealth effect occurs when acoustic waves hit smooth surfaces at an unfavorable angle and bounce away from the user. The wall disappears. AHRU's eliminates this problem by triggering diffuse reflection almost everywhere.
Okay, walk us through the physics of that diffuse reflection one more time. Why does the 8 millimeter wavelength make such a difference?
Okay, so diffuse reflection, where sound scatters in every direction like light off matte paint, occurs when the roughness of a surface is greater than the sound wavelength. Consider flash sonar, with wavelengths up to 800 millimeters, nearly a yard. To that massive wave, almost all concrete, walls, glass, and even typical asphalt appear perfectly smooth, like a mirror. Their roughness is tiny compared to the wave.
So when a smooth wall is at an angle, the reflection is directed away and the wall just vanishes acoustically.
Correct. But with the AHRUS system using the short 8 millimeter ultrasonic wavelength, many common surfaces, from rough road surfaces and crushed stone to meadows and typical interior walls, are inherently rougher than that short wavelength.
Ah, so to the 8 millimeter wave, those surfaces are no longer mirrors. They become rough, scattering surfaces.
Exactly. The sound wave is scattered diffusely in every direction, guaranteeing that enough of the sound energy returns to the user to generate an audible echo, even when the beam is pointed at a low glancing angle. The paper emphasizes that structured surfaces with a roughness of even just 4 to 8 millimeters become clearly audible. This fundamentally changes the user's perception of their environment, transforming the world from an unreliable mirror cabinet into a reliable textured acoustic landscape. Everything reflects something back.
That is a fundamental functional change that's huge. We have quantitative evidence of this difference, right? Let's look at a few comparisons from the evaluation data mentioned in the paper, specifically focusing on localization range. How much better is it, really?
The difference is truly staggering, yeah. Take a narrow obstacle, like a pole with a 5 centimeter diameter, about 2 inches. Flash sonar can typically perceive that pole at only about 0.6 meters, just under 2 feet away. that offers virtually no advance warning time. With AHR-US, that detection range dramatically increases to between 6 and 8 meters. That's like 20, 26 feet.
Wow. That is a 10 to 12-fold increase in the effective detection range of a narrow critical obstacle like a pole. That is the difference between stopping safely and walking straight into something. Game-changing.
And for larger objects, the increase is also significant, though maybe not as proportionally dramatic. A stationary car, for instance, usually detected by flash sonar around 3 to 4 meters away, maybe 10, 13 feet. AHR-US pushes that out dramatically to between 8 and 15 meters, so maybe 26 to almost 50 feet.
Oh.
This allows users far more time to plan direction changes and anticipate objects in their path, more situational awareness.
And complexity handling is also vastly improved, like telling things apart when they're close together.
Yes, it allows for the separate perception of overlapping objects. Flash sonar, due to its wide aperture and long wavelength, often cannot separate an object from its background, say a bush right in front of a wall. It all blends together into one complex echo. AHR-US, because it relies on the distinct acoustic textures generated by the chirps and diffuse reflection from that short wavelength, makes separation possible. Provided the overlapping objects have different surface structures, of course. The user hears the distinct acoustic texture of the bush overlaying the different texture of the wall behind it. They become distinct sound sources.
This technology really promises to deliver better results across pretty much every discipline of orientation and mobility. Let's look at the actual evidence from the first evaluation they did. Who were the test subjects and what did they learn? How did it go in practice?
Okay, the evaluation involved four subjects, two congenitally blind or blind for about 10 years, so experienced listeners in a sense, and two blindfolded sighted subjects acting as naive users. All were aged between 25 and 27. They were tested across five practical situations to assess things like directional perception, distance threshold, size estimation, border recognition, and distance differentiation. A good range of tasks.
Okay. In terms of directional perception, how accurately could they point to a target using only the AHR-US feedback?
Subjects were asked to point to an obstacle placed 5 meters away. The results were highly successful. The majority of subjects, particularly those who were already blind and had experience with spatial hearing, successfully located every single obstacle. This suggests that existing experience in spatial hearing translates quickly and effectively to the AHRE system. The learning curve wasn't impossibly steep.
That's promising. Let's focus on the distance perception threshold, the maximum distance at which an object could be detected. This is where the long-range advantage of AHRE should really shine.
It absolutely did. The subjects were tested on detecting a large car and a narrow pillar as they approached from known distances. Both subjects, who were already blind, outperformed the blindfolded subjects significantly. They heard the narrow pillar at a much higher distance, around 10 meters or so. The blindfolded subjects needed to be closer. The car, being a large obstacle, was heard immediately by everyone, as you'd expect. But this confirms that AHR-US delivers high selectivity and echo volume even at extended ranges, especially when paired with existing neural wiring for sound localization.
Interesting. They also tested width estimation. How accurate were they in determining the size of the obstacles? Could they tell if it was wide or narrow?
Yeah, subjects were placed 3 meters away and asked to simply show the width of the obstacle with their hands, gesturing the size. While the results showed some natural human deviation from perfect accuracy, nobody was perfect. The evaluation confirmed that a user can reliably get a rough impression about the size of an object. That's the key phrase. This is not a precision measurement tool for size, but it's critical for knowing if an object is a narrow pole you could easily skirt around or a wide wall you must stop for. Basic but vital information. This skill is also one that the researchers noted would likely sharpen significantly with dedicated practice over time.
Makes sense. And the crucial ability to perceive borders between different surfaces, say moving from a concrete sidewalk onto a grassy park area, how did that work?
A simple but critical test involved the border between grass and crushed stone, two distinct textures. All four subjects successfully recognized the border using the AHR-US system. They could tell exactly where one surface ended and the other began. This is a vital functionality for daily orientation and mobility, allowing users to track the edge of a path or sidewalk consistently just by listening to the texture change. This is where the diffuse backscattering from the short wavelengths really pays off, making the change in texture instantly audible as they scanned across the boundary.
Fantastic. Finally, distance perception differentiating between near, middle, and far. Could they categorize distance reliably?
They positioned an obstacle at 1, 2, and 5 meters, asking subjects to categorize the distance just based on the echo delay from the bursts. 3 out of 4 subjects performed this task very well, confirming the usefulness of the time delay bursts for relative distance judgment. The one who had difficulty noted that they believed their skill would improve substantially with more training time than the initial short session allotted for that specific test, which seems reasonable. So the overall takeaway is that the first evaluation confirmed AHRS dramatically improves perception across localization, distance, and structure recognition. And critically, the skills showed rapid improvement potential as training time increases. It's learnable.
So what does this all mean for the future of assistive technology? The development of AHRS seems to be a significant paradigm shift, doesn't it? Moving beyond simply giving a digital feedback loop and instead leveraging physics to augment the body's natural capabilities.
I think the synthesis is clear, yes. AHRUS is a true technological augmentation that eliminates the 3 key drawbacks of classical active echolocation: that lack of directivity, the poor resolution, and the critical stealth problem.
Yeah.
And it does this by brilliantly leveraging nonlinear acoustics and the short wavelength of ultrasound, physics solving a biological limitation.
It's a profound idea, really. It's a non-invasive, purely physical way to inject complex, high-resolution sensory data directly into the brain's existing spatial processing hardware without the need for cumbersome digital simulations or trying to trick the brain with imperfect digital audio.
And that's the most fascinating takeaway for you, the listener, I think. The AHRUS system doesn't seek to replace the human ear with complex digital headphones, massive processing power, and abstract interpretation layers. Instead, it uses a trick of physics, that nonlinear acoustics in the air, to physically transform high-resolution short-wavelength data into an audible sound that is already formatted for the individual's unique existing sensory channels. It relies entirely on the brain's existing subconscious ability to interpret acoustic stimuli, a skill honed since childhood. It works with the brain, not against it.
It is sensory augmentation that profoundly respects the organic architecture of the human brain. It feels elegant.
Exactly. And this raises an important question for you to consider. As all technology becomes more sophisticated, especially in areas like sensory aids or even virtual reality interfaces, will the future of sensory augmentation focus less on creating complex new mechanical senses, digital simulations of reality that the brain often struggles to integrate naturally, and more on finding clever physical ways like AHR use to feed complex high-resolution data directly into the sensory channels the human brain is already brilliantly wired to interpret? The goal perhaps isn't to build a better digital eye. Maybe it's about providing higher quality, organically formatted data to the existing, incredibly sophisticated operating system of the human mind. Something to think about.